Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here. We are going to start in Hebrews chapter 2, and we've got verses 14 through 18 to look at today. I'll read through those, but mainly we're going to be looking at chapter 2, verse 14, talking about death, the power of death, the fear of death, Jesus' victory over death, and Satan who holds the power of death, what that actually means. So we've got several things to look at here. It's really one of the most important points, important facets of Christianity is death and the conquering over death, the victory over death. So here we have it in chapter 2. We've been reading the last few weeks about Jesus being made like his brothers or becoming flesh and blood. And that's where this picks up. And we went through the last couple weeks talking about Jesus having been made a man, been made flesh and blood. Today it's going to be called blood and flesh is in the Greek. Sometimes it's translated flesh and blood because it's easier. Sometimes it's just translated, as far as being made human. But it means it's blood and flesh. And the idea with that is he had to experience the whole of mankind. He had to be born. He had to grow up. He had to learn. And then ultimately he's going to have to face death. And by doing this right here, he became just like us, and he's able to take, as God, be take all these things, including death, and bring victory over it, and then pave a way through death into life or resurrection. So he was made totally like us, and in that process, he is, besides just being like us, he's going to become the sacrifice or the propitiation in these verses. He's going to become the high priest to offer that sacrifice to God. These are all things that are coming up. The book begins with him being the creator, him being greater than the angels, him being greater than Moses, him being greater, his word being greater than the law of Moses. Well, now he becomes the man who's going to fulfill all the purposes of man. And then in the resurrected state, he's going to have his kingdom and take man to his highest potential in the kingdom that is coming. So here we pick it up. We went through some Old Testament verses last week where the writer of Hebrews draws out of Psalms and Isaiah where on this side of history, over here on this side, there's always going to be suffering. There's always going to be struggle. There's, in a sense, no resurrection victory on this side. We're just headed towards death. It's going to be the resurrection victory is going to be on the other side. Over here on this side, we've got hope. We have hope. We don't have the fullness of the hope. We don't experience the fullness of the resurrection. We have the hope. We have the fellowship with God. We have the Word of God. We have the Spirit of God. We have the power of God active in our life, mainly in this phase, to help us overcome sin, to help us sanctify our lives so we are not living in sin, bound to sin. But the ultimate victory is not even close on this side. We'll never experience the fullness of what God has for us in the resurrected state. And so this life, of course, is a life of suffering, and we're hoping for something better. With that condition, we as Christians, we have this worldview, we have this philosophy, we have this understanding that we're over here in this age, and it's going to be an age of struggle, it's going to be an age of suffering. We're going to have, momentary victories, but we all end in death. We all either grow old or get sick or perish. We never come out of this age in life. We never come out of this age victorious. We're all going to die, which is an interesting stat for all the people that want to follow the science today to realize that, if we do the numbers, it's like we have 100% death rate happening, and that's another whole subject. It's like what we need to do here is live free and live powerful in what we've got, knowing that we will all perish, and you're never going to overcome that. It's interesting where science is trying to go today is science is trying to bring the victory on this side. Now, this is something you need to watch for, is they are at secular humanism morphing into postmodernism, and they are trying to create what only Jesus Christ can create in the resurrected life. They're trying to create it here. No threats, no problems, no death. Everything is going to be pure. And as they're messing with this, they are going to screw up the system, the natural system, the genetic system. You can read about it in Revelation. You're messing with things that you can't control, and you're trying to fix things as man. As a fallen man, fallen human nature is trying to fix the fallen state of death, which we are trapped in and we cannot escape except through Jesus. But it is an attempt to be that Jesus, to be that Messiah, to be that victory. We're going to do things that we do not understand, that are beyond our capabilities, and we're going to touch things, move things. It's like taking a 3-year-old or a 4-year-old and letting them loose on your computer and get into the hard drive and start fixing things and start, well, I wonder what happens here. And you start deleting stuff. You're never going to get it back. You start pushing buttons. And that's what we're doing. And we think we're geniuses. We think we're at this high level. We are the highest level of beings on this earth. Secular humanism says our goal is to make this life perfect. Create a utopia, and that's a faulty thinking. So we watch as man rejects God, rejects Jesus Christ, rejects reality, and comes over here in this fallen state trying to fix it, and you can't. You can make it better. You can use all the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness. You can have a just system. You can use the advances that technology can bring us, but there's a limit. You cannot conquer death. You cannot conquer the fact that we are suffering, that we live in a physical body in an age that is fallen. And that's what's beautiful about a Christian worldview. It matches reality, which gives us the chance to manage what we have here, hoping for what we're going to get. This view is what created the scientific revolution. In the 1500s, you can go back and study. Everyone knows this. All the scientists were Christians, realizing coming out of the Dark Ages, where they're mixing chemistry or alchemistry and magic and the spiritual realm, trying to figure all these things out, hocus pocus. And they finally came to the conclusion that after they got the Bible released to all mankind, especially in coming out of the Catholic Church, was given the Bible, they realized God was a God of order and that they could look at creation through those lenses. It wasn't mystical and magical. There was a system they could use. It created the scientific revolution. That's what led us into the scientific age. But what they've gone now, they've gone beyond that. And in the scientific age, in the scientific revolution, the thing that they're standing on was the truth, the Word of God, that God was the organized creator bringing things out of chaos. They decided to throw away the foundation of God, of a solid foundation, of a solid creator that made things in order, and go with some evolution that we're just per chance. And they think we're on this evolutionary scale that we've come from nothing and we're evolving up. And in this process, they're not going to take control of this. Well, we are improving and in a sense becoming more technology educated, advances because of the scientific revolution. We're dealing with reality. We're analyzing our world based on reality. But once you leave reality and you're now basing it on the postmodern, you're no longer based on God's foundation. You're now creating science on something that is not based on truth, not based on reality. It's based on a false philosophy. It's based on hopes and dreams, wishes, feelings, emotions. And you don't understand that in the Christian worldview, you cannot escape death. It's here. The only hope you have is the life that is in Jesus Christ, that has been the pioneer, that's gone through death already, and will meet you on the other side with resurrected life. And then in his kingdom will take man to the fullness of his capacity, the fullness of his created ability. That is the utopia we're looking for. It's only going to be through God, his Savior, Jesus Christ, and the kingdom that is yet to come. We live in hope here. We realize we're going to fail here. Now you get a different worldview, and that's what's happening in our culture right now. You've got a worldview that's going to reject this eternity. They're going to reject the concept of God unless they morph it into their own image. And they're going to try to fix this. And that is going to lead to chaotic destruction. That, again, you read things in Revelation, if you want to read it literally. Things that are taking place. People are seeking death. They can't find it. There's, you know, they've got the mark of the beast, and all the kingdom breaks out in boils and sores. And there's all these things. What is happening right here? They've got weird creatures. Are these creatures demons? What is taking place? Again, you've got to go through and read it and study it, and we have several times. But some of those things you read and just go, huh, what is that? It may be because of where we're at today. Not that we are in those days, not that we're just moments away from it, not that we're looking at the mark of the beast today, but we may be seeing the postmodern, the secular humanism, all this stuff pushing us into an age where we're going to be messing with things genetically that we should not be touching because we don't have a Christian worldview. We've got a secular human worldview in a postmodern culture, and we're pushing buttons and changing things and putting things in our bodies that's going to do things that who knows what's going to happen. Again, it'd be nice to stick with the truth right here. That doesn't say we don't become, you know, advances in science, but we keep it in perspective. Anyway, here we go. We've got this in chapter 2, reading in the NIV, beginning in verse 5. It says, it is not to angels that he subjected the world to come. Now, that's important in what we're talking about which we are speaking. We're talking about that world to come. Our hope is in the world to come, when Jesus Christ returns as a man and takes man into his full potential. It is in that age, it is not angels that will be ruling. In this age, there are spiritual forces of evil. This is an age where God has given certain powers to angels or the spiritual forces, rulers and authorities in heavenly places. Ephesians 6, our battle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers and authorities in the heavenly places. In this age, in the age to come, they're not going to be a problem. That will be the age of man ruling under the ultimate man, Jesus Christ, the man who has become or just joined with us. But there is a place where someone has testified, what is man that you are mindful of him, the son of man that you care for him? You made him a little lower than the angels. You crowned him with glory and honor and put everything under him or under his feet. That's what they say. That's what man was created for. Everything is under man's feet. Which means, yes, we should take control of our world. And we make changes, we make adjustments, we make plans. In putting everything under him, God left nothing that is not subject to him. But then this next part, yet at present we do not see everything subject to him. If everything is subject to man, then everything I've said, that we are living in an age of suffering, we're all under the bondage of death and sin, we're going to struggle and suffer. Well, if man is, everything is under dominion, it's like, why is this not happening? We just got to get more educated. We just got to get more money. We just got to get more equality. We just got to get more what? Well, the problem is that's not going to happen. Man has fallen into sin. Yet at present, we do not see everything subject to him. We don't see this taking place. But we do see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels. That's when he was born. And he's going to live his life and die and pay for the sins of the world. We do see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels, now crowned with glory and honor. What we do see, we look at each other, we see people that are failing, they're growing old, they're dying, they're getting sick, they're struggling with sin. So we don't see this victory, but we do see Jesus, who did come as a man, live as a man, overcame sin, went to death, suffered the death on the cross, and then was resurrected and has gone into glory. That's what we see. That is our future. He's the pioneer that's blazed the trail. So we don't look at each other. How foolish it is to sit in a circle and look at each other and say, this is the best we've got. It's the best we've got now, but we do have a pioneer that's gone before us that we'll do the best we can now with the hope of where we're heading. But we see Jesus, who is made a little lower than the angels, now crowned with glory and honor because he suffered death so that by the grace of God, he might taste death for everyone. That's going to be the theme of what we're talking about today. He's tasted death for every one of us. The ultimate defeat of mankind, Jesus has already tasted it. Now we start talking about the children, the sons, the people that follow him, the believers. In bringing many sons to glory. In other words, he went before us and he's going to bring us to the same. He's already seated in glory and that's our fate. That is where we're heading. We're heading to glory. In bringing many sons to glory, it was fitting that God, for whom and through whom everything exists, should make the author of their salvation perfect through suffering. Again, notice, in bringing many sons to glory, he is not bringing the glory here. This is not the glory. We have resurrected life. We have the Word of God. We have a vibrant hope in the Word of God. You know, God can intervene in history, but we are not in glory, nor are we going to create glory on this side of history. We're going to be taken to glory. Jesus didn't experience glory here. He experienced suffering. He did have that moment on the Transfiguration where he demonstrated his glory. That was a mere demonstration to show his disciples, Peter, James, and John, who he was. And then he went to the cross, giving them the understanding that it's like, this is who I am, but this is what I'm going to do, and someday you will appear with me in glory. And that's what we're looking forward to. It's not going to happen here. It says, but the one who makes men holy and those who are made holy, verse 11, are of the same family or are one. So Jesus is not ashamed to call them brothers. He says, I will declare your name to my brothers. In the presence of the congregation, I will sing your praise. And that's in Psalm 22. We talked about that last week and the week before. The first half is the suffering on the cross or the suffering. The second half is the victory. So there's going to be the suffering, and then there's going to be the declaration of the victory. And the same thing here out of Isaiah. And again, I will put my trust in him, meaning when everyone else rejects God, rejects his plan, Isaiah says, I will put my trust in him. I know this is true. You're not listening. We're going to seal up the scrolls. I will put my trust in him. And then he says, here am I and the children God has given me. In other words, I'm sealing this up. He said, no one's listening, but I've got hope. And someday there's going to be me and my children who are testimonies today are going to be in the kingdom, in the glory with the Lord. So that's where we left off last week. Here's verse 14 to the end of the chapter. Now, this is new material. Since the children have flesh and blood. This is the NIV. We'll look at the English Standard Version right after this. Since the children have flesh and blood, he too shared in their humanity, so that by his death he might destroy him who holds the power of death, that is, the devil, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. For surely it is not angels he helps, but Abraham's descendants. For this reason, he had to be made like his brothers in every way in order that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in service to God, and that he might make atonement for the sins of the people, because he himself suffered when he is tempted. He is also able to help those who are being tempted. In closing this little reading right here, I want to look at verse 17 and 18, 19, or 17 and 18, and see where we're heading right here. And notice how rapidly it progresses in chapter verses 17 and 18. You're going to say, for this reason, he had to be made like his brothers. So again, there he's made like his brothers. He's got the flesh and blood like humanity. Why? In order that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest. The first thing now, right here, this is going to happen fast in these verses. Now, it's not the only time these things are going to be mentioned. He's going to become our high priest. The high priest is the one who represents man to God or represents God to man. He's the intermediate. He is going to be that perfect high priest. And he knows exactly what it's like to be a man so he can speak to God on behalf of man. That's the first thing. For this reason, he had to be made like his brothers in every way. He had to be made, this right here, he had to be made flesh and blood. And by being flesh and blood, he now can be a high priest for the other blood and flesh, or flesh and blood. Had to be made like his brothers in every way, that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in service to God. And here's another one. And that he might make atonement for the sins of the people. If you probably got a footnote there, that word would be like propitiation. Propitiation, or make atonement here. And the idea is there, we'll just write sacrifice. We got to clean that up later. But he's going to be the one who takes away God's wrath. God's wrath is being poured out on mankind, and Jesus Christ is the one who's going to be the sacrifice. He's going to be the atonement. He's going to be the one who propitiates or takes away that wrath. In the pagan world, they would have, it's easier to think about it in the pagan sense, they'd have the god of the mountain, the volcano, and he's upset and he's volcaning stuff out, or there's, you know, storms are rolling in and there's lightning. It's like, and so we got to propitiate his anger, got to give him something to make his anger appease him. And then they throw the person down into the volcano, a human sacrifice, and the anger is propitiated. That's the ideal of propitiation. I mean, you know, and that's a very barbaric way of explaining it. But the idea that God's wrath is going to be poured out on humanity or on the world, Jesus Christ is that propitiation that turns back his wrath. Now, there's multiple levels. He is the sacrifice. He is the atonement. There's many things about this that we're going to see, and we'll get into that. But this is the idea right here, atonement or propitiation, that he might make atonement for the sins of the people. They've sinned. God is angry. He gives God the propitiation. He gives himself as the sacrifice or the propitiation that turns back God's wrath. So he's the high priest. He's the sacrifice, or better yet, propitiation. Because he himself suffered when he was tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted. He now becomes our help in temptation, which is going to eventually be called a part of the role of the high priest. He knows where we're at. He's the high priest that's going to represent us to God. He's the propitiation that took away God's wrath. And now, because he understands what it's like to live as flesh and blood, what it's like to live on this side of history where we've got a sin nature. He did not have a sin nature, but he felt temptation, experienced temptation, and all the things, including learning and growing up and struggling and being rejected and eventually dying. He's able to help us, the children, in their temptation. Well, very quickly, we're not going to get to these things here today, but because he is flesh and blood, he is now the high priest, he's the propitiation, and he's able to now help us in this position where he's at, and that is what he's doing right now. He did not abandon us. He went to heaven and is now at the right hand of God, as we know in other places, interceding for us. He's on our side. Okay, now, let's go to the notes very quickly. I didn't have the whole thing. I didn't print off the whole thing, and I wish I would have now. But here are the verses on page 1, chapter 2, verse 14, the English Standard Version, the verse we're looking at today. Since, therefore, the children share in flesh and blood. And again, that's how the English Standard. If you want to do this real quick, you look down there in the Greek interlinear. Since, therefore, the children have partaken of blood and of flesh. So it's not a big deal necessarily unless you can make some kind of a connection. It is not flesh and blood in the Greek. It's blood and flesh, which is interesting because in Hebrew or in Ephesians chapter 6, when it says our battle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers and authorities in heavenly places, Paul writes our battle is not against flesh and blood. This writer says that he has partaken of blood and of flesh. And, you know, just that he's taken part of humanity. Blood and of flesh. Also, he likewise took part in the same things so that through his death he might destroy the one. And there it is in right there. You can see in the Greek, the one. And then right away again, another the. So ton, to, the one, to, the power. The one, the power holding of death, that is the devil. Now that's going to lead to a question. Does the devil have the power of death? Does Satan decide when you die? Is Satan killing people today? And that's, we're going to talk about that at least briefly. That's the Greek I read there. Going back to the English Standard, since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same things. And again, those same things could be the flesh and blood or the blood and flesh, but also the same things, the entire human experience. The fact that he was born as a baby and died as a man means he did everything else in between. He had to grow up. He had to, you know, learn. He didn't just instantly know, you know, information. There's two sides of Jesus, the hypostatic union. He is eternally God, so he was God the whole time. But as a man, his humanity had to be born. His humanity had to grow up. His humanity had to learn. His humanity died the whole time. That's why, in the Gospels, to help clear this up, in the Gospels, you can see very clearly, I don't want to say very clearly, sometimes very clearly, but you can see Jesus speaking like a man, but you can also see Jesus speaking from the divine viewpoint. You know, place where it's, you know, he's tired or he says, I'm thirsty or whatever. He's talking as a man or he's looking for information. He's asking questions. Sometimes the question was an educational rhetorical question to get the conversation started. But sometimes he's actually asking for information. But other times you see Jesus talking. And this is why when he gets into a debate with the religious leaders and the Pharisees, it's interesting because sometimes he begins to talk from the divine position and they start saying, well, this is what Abraham said, this is what Abraham thought, this is what Abraham was like. And he says, you're nothing like Abraham. He says, you don't know anything about Abraham. He says, I saw Abraham. I was there in Abraham's day. And Abraham did not think that. It's like, and then they know exactly what he's saying. And they said this to him. In the scriptures, it says, you're not yet 50 years old, and yet you say you've saw Abraham? The very fact, the way he replied to them, he's talking to them as if he'd been with Abraham. And they mocked him. He says, you're not even 50 years old, and you think you've been with Abraham? And then he says, before Abraham was, I am. He doesn't say before Abraham was, I was. He says before Abraham was, I am. And he throws down the gauntlet. He throws down the name of their God, I am. And says, before Abraham was, I am. Which means I was there in eternity past. So they're talking to the man Jesus, but they're talking face to face with deity in Jesus as they're having that conversation. So again, there's times where Jesus talks as a man, but there's times that he's going to speak as deity and from that perspective. There's going to be things that he'll talk, you know, he can remember creation. He can remember, I mean, he's not like, you know, and then we had the whole conversation. I mean, did he, you know, as a teenager begin thinking, you know, sometimes I just feel like God, you know, and then they had to go through, I mean, hold that transition. That's kind of a interesting thing. I think from the very beginning, even says in here, it says, when he comes into the earth, in these verses, when he comes into the earth, he says, it's coming up. This is a body you prepared for me. He says this in this book of Hebrews. It's going to say, when Jesus comes into the earth, he says, this is the body you prepared for me. And he's going to tell you, you don't want animal sacrifices, but you want this body to be the propitiation. So quoting the Old Testament, it gives the impression that Jesus, even in the manger as a baby, as an infant, was quoting scripture from his position of deity, quoting from the Old Testament, because those were his words. Now, again, he still had the humanity. You know, he couldn't talk and, you know, quote Plato or something in the cradle. But nonetheless, he has those two sides, hypostatic union, incarnation. I'm going to go back to page 1 and read the English Standard Version again. Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil. And then turn the page. I've got just two more verses on there. Verse 15, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. Notice right there, there's going to be a deliverance of the children who had been subject to a lifelong of slavery because of their fear of death. The children have a fear of death, and so they are held in slavery by this fear their whole life. They know. I mean, anyone who grows up, and again, I've told you the story before, I was 7 years old, and my mom and dad put me to bed. I was in the bedroom right down the hallway, and they're watching TV. I think it was like Johnny Carson or something, some late show, and I don't know what it was. Was it John Parr, maybe? Was in 1967? Was it Johnny Carson on there yet? Was it still Jack Parr? I don't remember. But nonetheless, I was in bed, and I was laying in bed just going to sleep. And again, this is a ridiculous story for you to have to listen to. But I, all of a sudden, I'm just thinking. You're just laying there in bed thinking, you know, going to sleep. And all of a sudden, I realize, I'm going to die. I mean, because everything, you know, as it was just that point in life where it just all came together. That everything had nothing, you know, I don't know what I was thinking about. I hope my dog doesn't die. You know, my grandma had died within a few months before that, maybe a year and a half or so, maybe a year. And so maybe you think, well, you know, I sure hope that doesn't happen to me. I can avoid death. And again, I was thinking of that. But all I remember is thinking all of a sudden, this is what I remember clearly. I'm going to die. And it was like, I'm dying. I'm right now. It was like, it doesn't matter. My thought was, it doesn't matter how long I live. I die. And it freaked me out. I got out of bed, went running down the hallway into the living room right in the middle of the late night show. I don't want to die. I mean, I said that, and of course, my dad's like, whoa, and that's just an example of, you know, then you start compensating, then you start like, well, you know, you start, and everybody in at some level knows this is their fate, and you can distract it, you know, you can have stay healthy, eat better, you can work out, you can get distracted, and there's people cope with this all kinds of ways. Ancient cultures, one of the themes in most ancient cultures is going to be death and burial and facing this beast of death. Part of that is because we always find tombs and inscriptions and monuments in their thoughts on death because it's the last stand. And, you know, many times they put it in stone. And you can read inscriptions even from this time period that Hebrews is being written on the pagan tombstones, it would be the Romans or the Greeks, of just the utter hopelessness of going to death. They fight it, and they know everybody they've ever seen goes to this death. I just got stuck on that again. It's almost like our culture is stuck in this mode of we're going to escape this. We're going to get rid of all of this. We are not going to have any fear of any kind of death. It's like, you know, that's something you've got to deal with, and you can't escape that. Well, anyway, this was a fear that the children were going to have, and the children here is talking about first of all, it can be all mankind, because Jesus shared in flesh and blood like all humanity, but when he's talking about children, or the family, or the sons, we're talking about out of all of humanity, those who have placed faith in Christ, we'll say believers. And believers who have their whole life had a fear of death, so they're held in slavery. Now, again, there's slavery to sin. We are slaves to sin, and we need to be delivered from our sin nature. That's another conversation. Jesus delivers us from our sin nature. This is a thought. This is a fear of death, and now you're in slavery to fear, trying to avoid this monster. And Jesus now is going to set, it says right here, chapter 2, verse 15, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subjects to lifelong slavery. Then the last verse is that I've got on page 2 that we'll get to next week. For surely it is not angels he helps, but he helps the offspring of Abraham. Now, when that's interesting, because you've got angels and offsprings of Abraham. And it's almost as if it's saying, just like it had said earlier in this chapter, it is not to angels he has subjected the age to come, but to mankind, or to Abraham's descendants. It's to the believers. It's mankind is going to be given this kingdom that's going to be coming. So angels are not part of that. In fact, Paul writes, in that age, we will judge angels. Mankind will be ruling over all that God has created, not just the trees and the fish and the birds, but all that God has created, which would include the spiritual powers. Now, deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to a lifelong of slavery, for surely it is not angels he helps. The author goes out of his way to say Jesus is not doing this for angels. Angels do not have, notice, they do not have a fear of death. There's no fear of death for angels. The angels are, if they are going to have anything take place, if you, we'll just throw demons and rulers and authorities and angelic powers into the whole big mix. But you can see the demons begging not to be thrown into the abyss. You can see at some point demons being released from the abyss. You can see angels are locked up in the underworld, in Sheol or in Tartarus, in the bottomless pit, we should say. Sheol seems to be more of a place where the humans go. But it would be the bottomless pit, Tartarus. They're locked up. Sometimes they're released. Sometimes they're not. Then ultimately, they're going to be thrown into the lake of fire. So the abyss, Tartarus, the bottomless pit, the lake of fire, Gehenna, is where the spiritual forces, they never die. There's no death experience. They're just here and then move somewhere else. So this death experience that Christ had is not going to do anything for angels. One, he's not helping angels. Two, they don't have flesh and blood. Death is an experience only experienced by flesh and blood. You have to be part of this creation to experience this death. And he is going to come and pay the price for them. Then it says, but he helps the offspring of Abraham. That is actually says the seed of Abraham. And now you've got to make a distinction and talk about it. When he says seed of Abraham, is he only coming for Abraham's descendants, you know, Israel? Or we go back to Galatians that Abraham's seed are those who believe the promise. And so again, I think that we'll get to, when we get to this, it'll be clear. That's really the only way of understanding it, is Jesus didn't just come for Israel. He came through Israel for the world, which included coming for Israel. But Abraham's descendants or Abraham's seed are those who have the same faith as him. Not the same genetics, but the same faith as Abraham. That's how you become a child of God. You're not born of God. You're not God's genetics, but you have faith. You become believers. In that sense, you are born again. In the same way, Abraham's descendants would be Abraham's seed that have been born of the same faith. And so we'll talk about that later. Anyway, let's go back to the notes on page 1. And since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, and that's why I've got some things written down here. I point out the actual Hebrew or the actual Greek. It's blood and flesh. This also is used in reverse order in Ephesians 6:12, and I've got that written out for you. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers of this present darkness, against the spiritual force of evil in the heavenly places. So you've got this right here is mankind is flesh and blood. And this is who Jesus joined with. He joined with this group. He is here to help this group. These are going to be his brothers out of this group. Some are going to become believers in him. They're going to join him in the family. And they can do that because he's their sacrifice, the propitiation. He's their priest. He can help and assist them. On the other side, this is not who we're battling. The Christian battle is not against these people. We've said it very clearly in Ephesians and in, because we went through these verses, and in Colossians. Our battle is not against other men or humanity, because these are people that have been taken captive. If we have anything to do with other people that are outside the faith, is we look at them as captives, people that have been confused. They've been taken into this age of darkness, because the age that all of us are living in is this temporal age. It's called here the age of darkness. And who is ruling in this age of darkness? First of all, Satan is the god of this age. And then it goes on and says right here in this Ephesians quote, point 1b, for we do not wrestle against flesh and blood. This is not who we're wrestling against, but against the rulers, against the authorities. And again, if you put that in context, we're not talking about governors and presidents and kings. We're talking about the spirit, because governors, presidents, and kings would be flesh and blood. So we're not ruling or struggling against kings and presidents and governors. We're ruling against the spiritual forces, rulers in the heavenly realms, against the authorities in the heavenly realms, against the cosmic powers. Notice right there, this is the English Standard Translation, cosmic powers over this present darkness. So this present darkness that we live in, or all of humanity lives in, is under the control of rulers, authorities, cosmic powers, all under the leadership of Satan. It's the age of darkness, and that this is where we're living. So, I mean, this is important that we come to this recognition. This is where we are at historically. This is not a matter of a Democrat or Republican. This is not a matter of Russia or China or some people group or some philosophy. All are in this age of, this is where we live. I live in this age of darkness. Everyone has lived in this age of darkness, under the control of rulers and cosmic powers in this age of darkness. In this darkness, John writes, he sent the light. The light has come. And the light is not going to change this age. It's going to deliver you, give you clear thinking in this age, and put hope in this coming future, the future of the Son of God. And so we're in this age. It says here, against the cosmic powers or this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realm. So this age of darkness is also identified as evil. And so in this age, mankind finds himself living. And in this dark, evil age, under the rule of rulers and cosmic powers, Satan himself, man knows his ultimate fate is death. And this is, if you pull the curtain back and looked at this, this would be a terrifying place to be. Well, you're there. It's just, you've surrounded yourself with distractions and false philosophies and things. And also, as a believer, you place faith in Jesus Christ. And in this age, you have hope. And one of the reasons this can change society. Imagine an entire society that is in darkness and is trying to solve their problems in their dark age with the process of evil, while they're being led and motivated and manipulated and influenced by rulers and cosmic powers who are in control of this dark age. Ultimately, Satan is in charge, and now man is siding with this, trying to figure out their problem. I mean, it's going to be chaos. It's going to be false philosophy. It's going to lead to just a continuous decline into darkness until the whole society just collapses. This age right here can find hope when the message of Jesus Christ, the truth of the Creator, is brought into this, and the light can shine. And Jesus has shined his light into darkness, John chapter 1, but darkness has not understood it. Not that they rejected it. They don't understand it. It's like, I have no place for this understanding. I cannot process this information. There are people within here who will reject it, but basically there's no understanding. The whole point of that is, going back to this flesh and blood, there's interestingly that in these verses in Hebrews, in chapter 2, verse 16, he talks about angels. And in chapter 2, verse 14, he talks about the devil, which ties right into this forces. It's not angels he helps, and the power of the fear of death is held by Satan. And the whole concept here is flesh and blood is going to be delivered from this age of angelic dominion and Satan's rule. Next point, point two. It was only with blood and flesh that Jesus could access death. Spiritual forces do not die. I've already said that. And then only blood and flesh have to face death. Point three. The spiritual forces that hold the fate of death or power over the blood and flesh in an attempt to manipulate and control them. Now we come to this part of the verse where we have the power of death, the fear of death. We're going to have the slavery of death, and you're going to have Satan, who is holding something. And the question now is going to be, how much power does Satan have? And the presentation is going to be this. Satan does not control death. Now, if you read let me read the NIV, and you can hear in here that Satan must have a lot of control. And these are verses you have to study, and if you just read through them, sometimes you can get misled. Since the children have flesh and blood, he too, Jesus, shared in their humanity so that by his death he might destroy him who holds the power of death. Destroy Satan, the devil, who holds the power of death. So there he's holding the power of death, and Jesus is going to destroy Satan, that is the devil, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. First of all, Satan, there's this fear of death, and the people are held in slavery by their fear of death. So there is this power of death because you're afraid of it, and now you can be manipulated. It's like holding something over someone's head. It's almost like a terrorist threat. It's like you are going to death, and you're trying to figure out what you're going to do, and Satan is holding this over them. I've got some verses here. We maybe want to look at them, but first of all, on page 2 of the notes, point 4, we maybe should go back and read a little bit of it. Point 4, the devil does not cause death or control death. Now again, he can be involved in it, he can lead, he can tempt you. The Lord does control death, cause death, but the devil can use this ultimate fate as a source of fear in humanity. Job chapter 2, verse 6, and the Lord said to Satan, behold, he is in your hand, only spare his life. So let's go to Job chapter 1 and 2 very quickly. I don't know if we should do this or not. Job chapter 1, yeah, there's an entire storyline here. Chapter 1 of Job, verses 1 through 5, they're talking about Job. Very clearly, he's blameless, upright, feared God, shunned evil. He's a righteous man. He's doing everything to please God. This appears to be before the days of Moses, probably back during the days of Abraham, because he's still the priest of his family. There's no mention of Israel, no mention of the covenant, no mention of Abraham. He is the priest for his family. There's no priesthood. It appears to be the days of the Gentiles before Abraham was called and definitely before Moses. Verse 6, one day the angels, and right there, that's a great word right there. There's your word, sons of God, right out of Genesis chapter 6. The sons of God came to present themselves before Yahweh, and Satan also came with them. So Satan is one of the sons of God, one of the angels. And Satan says, God, the Lord, Yahweh said to Satan, where have you come from? Satan answered his Lord. Now again, notice this. Satan is not interrupting the meeting. I like to think about it this way. God is having a council of all the angelic hosts, and they are all in the midst of the assembly, and they are all under his authority. There's not this group of rebellious terrorist unit out there that no one can find, if they got underground tunnels or something. When he calls them, they show up. If at some point in history they violated some kind of agreement, some kind of treaty, some kind of reality, they appear to have been sent into the bottomless pit and are kept in chains of everlasting darkness. Peter records that. We see it in other places. Jude refers to it. So there are angels, spiritual forces, that have been removed from history. Even the demons beg Jesus not to send them into the abyss. And he didn't. He sent them into the pigs. And again, that's another whole conversation. The Lord said to Satan, where have you come from? Satan answered the Lord, from roaming through the earth and going back and forth in it. That is his domain. He is in charge of this earth. He's roaming through this earth. This might be the first book ever recorded here, not necessarily first in historical events, because you're going to have the book of Genesis occurring, but this may be the first book recorded, the most ancient written record. Except Genesis, you're going to have accounts that may have been written down as sections of information that are all weaved together by Moses. Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job?" Now, this always terrifies me, because Job's just going around the earth, and then God brings up Job, not because he's been bad, but just because it's like, hey, in this angelic conflict, have you considered Job? I mean, you think you're wrong. Satan says, roaming through the earth, going back and forth in it, which means he's not just wandering around, he's controlling. The reason he's roaming around, he is stinking in charge. Where have you come from? Wherever I want to go in the earth, I'm roaming around, going back and forth, to and fro. It's my place. I go where I want to, do what I want to. Well, he says, have you considered Job? You're not doing too good in that territory. Job is, he says, have you considered my servant Job? There's no one like him on earth. He's blameless, upright, man who fears God and shuns evil. He says, yeah, well, you're really tearing up the earth. You're having dominion. He says, you haven't got Job yet. It looks like I still got a foothold in the earth. I've still got Job. And then Satan says, well, does Job fear God for nothing? Satan replied, have you not put a hedge around him, his household and everything? In other words, he's got everything he wants. Why would he not worship? You've given him everything he wants. He's got money, family, wealth, everything he's got. He's got health. And God says, look at this, verse 12. The Lord said to Satan, very well, then, everything he has is in your hands. But on the man himself do not lay a finger. Now notice right here, the Lord controls this. He says, okay, Satan, you can touch Job. You can touch his stuff. But you can't touch his body. In other words, you can take all of his stuff. And then this is a test. This is a test between God, Yahweh, and Satan. And Job is the pawn in the middle. And I tell you that again. Job is the pawn in the middle. Job is a man. God is resolving a conflict between God and Satan. God and the rulers of this age. He's resolving a conflict through man. And man is choosing on his own free will to follow God in this dark age. And God is rubbing it in Satan's face. And Satan says the reason he's doing that is because you're giving him stuff. God says, okay, I think he can stand up without stuff. So Satan, as you know the story, everything happens. All this stuff is destroyed. Satan went out from his presence. One day when Job's sons and daughters were feasting and all this, everything, as everything was blown away, there's an invasion. They killed everybody. And then fire came from God, apparently fell from the sky and burned up the sheep. And everybody comes back and reports to Job. And verse 20, at this, Job got up and tore his robe and shaved his head. He fell to the ground and worshiped. Naked I came from mother's womb, naked I depart. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised. Exactly what Satan doesn't want to hear. It's like, you're supposed to be living in fear. I just took everything from you. It's like, I'm still committed to the Lord. There's nothing that I came with. I mean, I had nothing. It's all the Lord's. In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. Chapter 2, on another day, the angels came to present themselves before the Lord. So it seems like these monthly council meetings are, you know, occurring frequently. They probably do Zoom now. But and Satan also came with them to present himself before him. In other words, present, where have you come from? He's got to present himself. What's going on? They are still under the authority of Yahweh. And the Lord said to Satan, where have you come from? Satan answered, the Lord. Or Yahweh, from roaming through the earth and going back and forth in it. Then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? There's no one like him. He still maintains his integrity. You took everything from him and you try to incite him and you try to get him to turn on me and side with you in this dark age. He says, but he still maintains his integrity. Then Satan says, skin for skin. He says, a man will give all he has for his own life, but stretch out your hand and strike his flesh and bones, and he will surely curse you to his face. He says, you just took his stuff, but this flesh and blood, this flesh and bone, you strike that, you strike his body, he'll curse you to his face, your face. And, well, of course, he goes out. Job gets all these sores and boils, and he's scraping himself, having all kinds of trouble trying to ease his pain. His wife comes out, gives him some bad advice, then his three friends show up. And I'm trying to find this right here. Okay, skin for skin. And the Lord, okay, yeah, there it is, verse 6. The Lord said to Satan, very well, then he is in your hands, but you must spare his life. Who has the authority of death? God. God has the authority over all the possessions, and then Satan's only going to take something. Again, this is harsh. This is harsh. People don't want to hear this. This doesn't preach well in Tulsa. I remember this didn't preach well in Tulsa at all. It's like if someone is going to get destroyed financially, it's going to have to be approved by God. Things don't happen unless Yahweh allows it to happen. That's the Bible. He is the Alpha and the Omega. Satan is the liar. He comes to kill, steal, and destroy. But he doesn't kill, steal, or destroy anything that God doesn't allow to happen. A sparrow doesn't fall out of the sky unless God knows it's going to happen. Not just knowledge of it. I mean, oh, something bad's going to happen. He's going to check it off. At these, apparently, again, I'd have to build this case more, but at these monthly meetings or at these councils, God is approving. We can see it take place. Who's going to lead Ahab to his death? It says one said this, another said this, and finally a spirit came up and says, I'll be a lying spirit in the mouths of his prophets. And God says, Yahweh says, that will work. In other words, one said this, God rejected it. One said that, God rejected it. Finally, one says, he's got himself surrounded by false prophets. I'll be a lying spirit and give him some encouraging words to lead him to his death. God says, yes, that's acceptable. Notice that the man Ahab had opened himself up for that attack. But nothing could happen except Yahweh said to the lying spirit, yes, you can do it. So even the lying spirits are given permission. Again, when you start seeing a decline of a culture, understand this. This puts an exclamation point on where we're at. When you start seeing a decline in the culture and things start to unravel, it's not because God has lost control and Satan now is moving in. Satan has moved in because God has somehow given permission. And a lot of times that permission comes from man's behavior, man's actions, man's attitudes, what he desires. He'll warn, he'll put fences up, he'll help man. Job had fences around him and God took him down under, you know, with Satan was using, God was using him as a pawn. But nonetheless, when you start seeing things unravel, God is in control of that unraveling. And he talks about repenting and being brought back, but there's also a place where God just walks away and lets the thing unravel. Not because he's out of control. When Jerusalem burned in 70 AD, who was in control? God. When it burned in 586, who's in control? God. He's even saying, I'm going to do these things. But right here, we get to see right there, God is in control. So when it talks about this right here, the power of death, the fear of death, the slavery of death, and Satan holding the power, that doesn't mean Satan is calling the shots. That means who put man in this position? When Adam sinned, he had been told, the day you eat of it, thou shalt die, or dying, thou shalt die. God put, that was the choice, A or B. You choose this, you get death. Adam did this, God put this into place. And so now Satan is going to use this position, this reality, he's going to hold it over man and bring power, fear, and cause slavery of mankind because of that. Luke chapter 12, verse 5. This is Jesus teaching. He says, but I will warn you whom to fear. Fear him who, after he has killed, has authority to cast into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him. So let's go to Luke chapter 12, and you can see right there, he's not talking about Satan. He's not saying you should fear Satan. He's saying the one you should fear is that after he has killed you, he can send you into hell. Chapter 12, beginning in verse 5 here. Yes, I got to read chapter 12, verse 1. Meanwhile, when the crowd, Luke chapter 12, verse 1, when a crowd of many thousands, amazing, a crowd of many thousands had gathered so that they were trampling on one another, Jesus began to speak first to his disciples, saying, so Jesus, there's thousands of people. Jesus addressing the inner group to his disciples, the people crowding around trying to hear in the overflow rooms, kind of like what it is this morning here. Be on your guard, he says, against the yeast of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. The yeast of the Pharisees is the teaching of the Pharisees. It's hypocrisy. They teach one thing, they do another thing. There is nothing concealed that will not be disclosed or hidden that will not be made known. What you have seen in the dark will be heard in the daylight, and what you have whispered in the ear in the inner rooms will be proclaimed from the roofs. In other words, he's talking probably about his teaching. I'm teaching you here. We're going to proclaim it to the world. I tell you, my friends, do not be afraid of those who kill the body and after that can do no more. In other words, do not. This is a good message for us even now. This is Jesus preparing for this right here, this fear. Do not be afraid if someone can take and enforce death on you, or they can threaten you and cause fear that they're going to kill you, or they can hold you in slavery and make you do things, because if you don't do what we want, we're going to kill you. So if it be the power of death, they can actually execute you, or the fear, or causing slavery because of this fear of death. Jesus says, don't do that. Do not be afraid of any man or even Satan who's going to try to bring death. That's all they can do, that they can bring death. But there's nothing after that. Once they kill the body, they're done. They're done. Now, this is harsh teaching, because between being threatened and death, there could be a lot of painful things take place. He says, I tell you, my friends, do not be afraid of those who kill the body and after that can do no more. Again, notice right away, Jesus not saying, do not be afraid of man, my friends. If they try to kill you, I'll protect you. They'll never touch you. I mean, he doesn't say that. He just tells you, when they do kill you, don't be afraid. But what do you mean, when they do kill you? It's like, what? They're going to kill you. It's like, oh, that's not what I want. I want a different religion. But I will show you whom you should fear. And this is the truth. First of all, you're all going to die. So do not fear those who use this death as a threat. And once you're dead, their power is gone. This is probably the most important message we can say at this time in our culture. Do not fear those who can bring death. But once you're dead, they're nothing. They've been vaporized of any kind of authority. But fear him who, after killing the body, has power to throw you into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him. Are not five sparrows sold for 2 pennies? Yet not one of them is forgotten by God. Indeed, the very hairs on your head are numbered. Don't be afraid. You are worth more than many sparrows. I tell you, whoever acknowledges me before men, the Son of Man will also acknowledge him before the angels of God. But he who disowns me before men will be disowned before the angels of God. Now, and that's this point right here. When men come and threaten you right here, realize that if you talk about preparing your soul for what's coming, this is probably one of the starting points. Is when men come and threaten you with death or persecution, realize that once you're dead, their authority is gone. It's only of this temporal world. Satan can use that and hold you in fear of death. But Jesus says the truth is that there is another layer, another kingdom, another dimension, and those who have power at this age and they can kill you, when they die, when he kills them on earth, he can also throw them in the lake of fire forever. His authority, you may die in this age, but be rewarded for eternity. They who bring this death, including Satan, will, now again, he's not going to die, but they will perish and end up in the lake of fire. So again, the obvious example there is do not fear man, but fear God. And going back to our text now, back to our notes, tick-tock. Jesus, by dying and being resurrected, destroyed any fear that comes with the ultimate fate of death for the children or believers. There was the promise of resurrection, but the work had not been done. With the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, the resurrection now is an absolute go. Operation Resurrection is a go. 1 Corinthians 15:26, I'll read these very quickly. The last enemy to be destroyed is death. Death will be destroyed. We got to read 1 Corinthians 15 in a little more detail next week. 1 Corinthians 15:54-57. When the perishable puts on the imperishable and the mortal puts on immortality, then shall come to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is your victory? O death, where is your sting? And that's what this is right here. There's a day coming. And again, it began with the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And this is scary stuff. Death is scary. It is overwhelming. But there's a day coming. Jesus has experienced. He paved the foundation, or the pioneered the way already. But there's a day coming where universally the believers will say, where is this victory of death? Death has no victory. There is no sting of death. It's just like passing through, like David writes, passing through the valley of the shadow of death. There's nothing there. It's used to intimidate you, but as a believer, you just pass. It's like walking from one room into the next room. It says, Death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is your victory? Death, where is your sting? The sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law. But thanks be to God who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Paul writes that in 1 Corinthians 15. Revelations 1:18, Jesus says, I died, and behold, I'm alive forevermore. And I have the keys of death and Hades. Luke 11:21. Jesus says, when a strong man fully armed guards his own palace, his goods are safe. But when one stronger than he attacks him and overpowers him, he takes away his armor in which he trusted and divides his spoil. Whoever is not with me is against me, and whoever does not gather with me scatters. In other words, the idea there is Satan, they're talking about Satan having power at that time. But Jesus was saying someone more powerful than Satan is here. And when he says he's got his house protected, but I'm going to break into his house, take all of his stuff and divide the spoil. And then where's his battle? There'll be nothing left. And that he's clearly talking about that. Chapter 1, or verse, 1 John chapter 3, verse 8. You know this verse. Whoever makes a practice of sinning is of the devil, for the devil has been sinning from the beginning. The reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the works of the devil. And that is in context talking about sin. But I do not think, and we'll pick this up next week, I do not think Satan has the authority of death. I think Satan is using the natural threat of death to frighten, to manipulate, and motivate people of this earth to do certain things, to stay away from God, thinking exactly that's what Job was going to do, that Job would cower away from it, and yet he didn't. The threat now, especially with hope in Jesus Christ, this threat now, we're still going to die. If you do not know Jesus, you still are under the authority, in a sense, of Satan's threat of, I don't know, I will compromise, I'll do anything to stay alive. What do I need to do to spare my life? I have no hope except now. But with Jesus Christ coming, his resurrection, and the Word of God, we have this hope, we have this truth. And so all of a sudden, Satan says, boo. It's kind of like, boo-hoo. There's nothing to worry about. We're going on to victory. You kill me, your power's done, and I'm in glory. It's like, oh. And that is not just in the angelic world a threat to them, but even in this age today, it's like, do your best. But I've got hope in Jesus Christ. Now, the person, the flesh and blood bringing that persecution, that flesh and blood bringing those threats that Satan's enforcing, our battle is not with them. But if they don't switch sides, they're going to meet the one who has power of death that can destroy their body in this age, but also their soul in eternity. Our hope is here. And I think that's what it's saying right there. It's very simply saying, we no longer have, since Jesus Christ has been resurrected, there's no longer fear. Satan no longer has the hold of the power, the threat of death. He never had the power of death, but he always had the threat. And even now today, he's got the threat of death for many people. Imagine how many people today are manipulated by fear, the fear of death, the fear of anything. And it's like they have no hope. It's like, bring your best shot for the believer who has prepared their soul, not just the believer, the average believer who's got some shallow Christianity will go right. They do not understand. They'll go right back into fear. But the person that believes and understands the hope that is in Jesus Christ, that he has resurrected, he has pioneered the way into the coming age, that we have no fear, that when once we're done with this age, we're heading into the next age to a place of greater glory, greater power, a greater fulfillment. And those of this age are going to be left behind, historically irrelevant. And so that is the good news. I think that's what they're talking about there. It's like there's no fear of death. And that's going to unravel many things, many of the strategies of the powers of darkness. I'll pray and we're free to go. Father, do thank you for your truth. We thank you for the opportunity to look at these things. We ask that you would again make them clear to us, help us understand them and actually apply them in our lives and live them before people, that we may have hope and we may share that hope with others. We thank you for Jesus Christ, for the Word, and for the Spirit that abides within us. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for being here.